Well, good morning. And thank you right at the beginning
to government. So I'll briefly approach the biotechnology challenge for each of these from specifically genetics, a leading edge of current biotechnology. With just 20 minutes, I will only briefly highlight certain ideas as an invitation for further conversation. So, first, genetics and individual freedom. Have you ever thought about the complexity of the human eye? Do you think, given time, that you could make one? You'd need the chemical formula for the tough but transparent lens, the right depth across the lens to focus the light on the array of rods and cones that form the retina, have to assemble an ocular nerve and brain tissue organized to interpret the resulting signals. Could you do it? What do you think? It looks to me like most of you are being too hard on yourselves. It looks like most of you have indeed already done it, right? In fact, it looks like most of you have already done it twice. So how did you do that? All of the necessary design and assembly information is in your genes. In fact, the necessary information is in every nucleated cell in your body. And you have about 3 billion nucleated cells in your body. So you have about 3 billion full copies of all the information that's needed to design and to assemble bone and spinal cord, heart and lung, insulin and adrenaline, all of the amazing wonders in a single human body. It's an amazing system, formative for your physical body, but it's not absolutely determinative. Two people with identical genes, we call them identical twins, will have different fingerprints. If one identical twin develops type 1 diabetes, the chances that the other will do so is about 50%. That's a much greater chance than for the general population because of bearing the same genes, but not 100%. Genes deeply shape our physical bodies, but they do not completely determine them. Genes also shape our behaviors, but they do not completely determine what we do. How does a cockroach know to flee the light? Well, that's a behavior built into its genetic code. Without it, it would not live long enough to pass on its genetic code. Animals at the insect level follow their behavior coding by rote. A worker ant will do what a worker ant does, whether placed on an iceberg or at the family picnic. It does one set of genetically encoded behaviors and one set only. But as genetic beings become more complex, their responses and choices gain flexibility. Present a dachshund puppy with a puddle of water, and they will maybe sniff it if they show any interest at all, right? If you've ever done that. Present a retriever puppy with a puddle of water, and they will joyously dive in. It's actually part of the genetic code of that retriever that it is attracted to and wants to play in the water. But a dog has sufficient intelligence to channel or even refuse its genetic tendencies. It can be trained to only jump in the water with its owner's command, or even to not want to go in the water at all. At the level of complexity of a dog, a mammal can respond to its genetic tendencies and follow them or not. Now, when we get to people, we have genetically endowed behavioral tendencies as well. I'll give you an example. When you open the refrigerator door late at night, which looks more intriguing, the Häagen-Dazs or the celery? My guess would be, for most people, it's going to be the Häagen-Dazs, the premium ice cream. Now, there's actually a genetic reason for that. Most human beings carry a genetically built-in propensity to prefer the taste of fat. The juicy steak looks more mouth-watering than the dried-out one. When calories are scarce, the best survival strategy is to seek out high-fat foods, since they're calorie-rich. When calories are abundant, the healthiest choice may be the celery. We have sufficient mental capacity to feel our genetic propensities, but we do not have to blindly follow them. Mouse mothers have a gene called FOSB that is essential to their pups. The gene gives a biological reward to the mouse mother for lying still while the pups nurse. If the gene is knocked out, removed, the mouse mother will not hold still for the pups to nurse, even allowing them to starve to death in a cage with her. Now, most human parents carry the identical FOSB gene. There's a biological reward for feeding one's young. It feels good. It feels right. But can a parent feed her child if she lacks the FOSB gene? Of course she can. Human beings are influenced by our genes, but not determined by them. Clearly, the strongest genetic marker for criminal violence is, incontrovertibly, the Y chromosome. Now, that does not mean that everyone who bears a Y chromosome will be, nor should be, criminally violent. As human beings, we are influenced by our genetic heritage, but we have sufficient emergent complexity that we can choose to encourage, channel, or resist given genetic tendencies. What our genes give us is terrain, inclinations toward what has been successful before, not a determined path. Such inclinations are helpful advice, but not to be followed necessarily. Our genetic tendencies often conflict. How do we adjudicate between natural tendencies toward pair bonding and polygamy, parental care and infanticide? Further, such tendencies are often unaware of context. A desire for sexual intercourse may be appropriate to act out in one situation, but not another. We are sufficiently conscious to choose which genetic tendencies or conflicting motivations to act out, when or not at all. We can even choose goals not encoded in our genes. There is no gene or set of genes, at least none that we know of to date, that specifically drive one to compose a violin concerto. We are shaped by our genes, but are sufficiently conscious of them to choose whether to follow them, redirect them, or resist them. Our genes do not determine all our physical form, and our physical form does not determine all of who we are. One identical twin can become a carpenter and the other a writer. One identical twin can become a Buddhist and the other a Christian. Genes play an important part, but we still have substantial individual freedom. Because one has an inherited genetic propensity for alcoholism does not mean that one should go forth and be the best alcoholic one can be. We have the individual freedom to choose what we do with our genetic tendencies. Genetics and moral virtues. Professor Arnhart has forcefully argued that our Darwinian origins offer virtuous guides for our individual freedom. If I'm understanding him correctly, Dr. Arnhart proposes that genetic tendencies endowed by random mutation and selection for their reproductive success should lead our choices. These feelings offer a kind of natural law rooted in our physical heritage. I agree that taking seriously what has worked before is prudent. We are each at the end of a long chain of choices that worked. If not, we would not exist for this conversation. But inherited structure does not necessarily dictate best future use. Structure developed for one end can be turned to another, and this is essential to Darwinian evolution. The multiplicity of life forms and survival strategies that we see now depends by that theory on novel use and development of received structures. Structures furthering one purpose were turned to others. Fins became legs for life on land, and then over time, the legs of some mammals adapted back to fins for life again in the sea, whales. Every new capability was the alteration or extension of an old one. This is at the very center of the evolutionary paradigm. Now, the ID movement highlights instances of what they term irreducible complexity in biological life. Michael Behe cites bacterial flagellum. There are other examples given in Darwin's Black Box.
Behe and William Dembski, prominent founders of the ID movement, acknowledge common descent over aeons of time. They're both glad to affirm that. They think the evidence is clear. But they see crucial moments when random mutation and environmental selection would not be sufficient to produce this irreducible complexity. Now, the usual response of those who advocate Darwinism is that some structures are developed by incremental steps, each step rewarded, and then by feasible minor mutation turned to a new use. Picture a developing ladder that is more effective each time one adds one rung. Eventually, it's quite tall. Now, a single random mutation undermines one leg so that the ladder falls over, surprisingly, in just the right place to offer a helpful bridge. Because it's helpful in that position, it is also replicated from then on as a bridge. One could not rightfully picture the bridge building one rung at a time over the chasm, because there would be no reward to reinforce any of the many sequential additions until it was complete. But built for another task, and then falling into just the right place whole, might account for it. Now, the odds against such are astronomical. But that, of course, is the point of the Darwinian emphasis on the vast number of attempts at any given moment multiplied over vast periods of time. If there are possible rewarded incremental steps, over so many attempts, over so much time, the chance of them occurring becomes more conceivable. Now, my point here is not to argue for or against ID. What I want to note now is that essential to the idea of Darwinism is the idea of structures developed for one purpose that end up serving another. Darwinism depends on past structures not dictating future uses. By this system, whatever human beings have inherited does not dictate what they should do with that inheritance now. Darwinism may insightfully describe the past, hence part of the current structure we have received, but it cannot prescribe the present as normative. That would be inherently contradictory to its most basic mechanism. A closed Darwinian system of random mutation and selection does not support stasis, either physical or moral. Historic selection can develop capabilities for survival that we can turn to other uses. We can choose to follow past strategies or not to. Genetics and limited government. There are multiple candidates for guiding our current choices besides our genetic heritage. Kant's appeal to rational consistency, Hinduism to the law of karma, Buddhism to an experience of enlightenment, Islam to the will of our Creator. Considering all the proffered alternatives, it is interesting that we have as much global consensus on basic moral commitment as we do. The United Nations Declaration of Human Rights exists. One can circle the globe and consistently find people pair bonding and raising children. That could in part be attributed to our common physical challenges, such as childbearing, or even in part to what genetic behavioral strategies have been successful to date. However, there's also enough variation in our moral understanding and application that we might best hope for what Robert Nozick called a utopia of utopias. Where we have sufficient agreement, we can require and provide as a society. Where we differ, we do well to allow varied approaches. A contemporary example might be requiring education for our youth, but supporting a multiplicity of approaches to achieve it, such as public, private, charter, or home schools. While we're not doomed to replicate at the social level the vast trial and error of genetic heritage, our thoughtful experimental approach that is willing with deference both to allow different attempts to see what best serves and to value different outcomes may be most fruitful. That would require a limited government that does not try to lockstep everyone in every way. All right, so in sum, the genetic and archaeological evidence for common descent is compelling. Descriptions of that process can offer insightful context for understanding human nature and politics. It can be helpful to know that we can appeal to certain what appear to be universal moral feelings embedded in our genes. But human beings are at a level of complexity that our genetic heritage is formative, not definitive.
we can do better or worse than our genetic momentum. We can choose and need to. Since our genetic tendencies are not univocal, they're not aware of context, and they're not ultimately authoritative. How we sort and apply our genetic tendencies requires more than just listening to our genes, whether for individual freedom, moral virtue, or for limited government. Thank you for your kind attention.